As the demographic landscape of the U.S. changes, so has the American palate. Today we're cooking with and sprinkling on spices that just a decade or two ago most Americans couldn't even name. NPR's Andrea Hsu begins her report at the headquarters of a company that's racking up sales because of this.
Just north of Baltimore, I've put on a white jacket, safety goggles, and a hairnet. I'm about to enter the most pungent place in America I've ever been.
So, Andrea, as you can see, this is a large packaging room right here. We have 12 production lines in our department of Spiceville.
Joe Dilworth is a production team manager for McCormick, the largest spice company in the world. The air inside this vast plant is warm and heavy with the smell of garlic and oregano.
The annual volume of the plant this year is going to be over a billion eaches or a billion bottles produced in this plant.
Adding up to more than $3 billion in sales for this company last year. Among McCormick's best sellers are black pepper, cinnamon, and garlic powder. Recently, it's rolled out things like roasted coriander and roasted cumin. With the help of some 40,000 consumer testers, the company has concluded that, yes, people will buy those things.
It's all about the consumer. We are very consumer-driven.
Food scientist Marianne Gillette has been with McCormick for more than 30 years. Part of her job is finding out what people like and dislike. She tests people for neophobia and neophilia, fear of new foods and love of new foods.
When we started some of our work with neophobes about 5 years ago, things like pomegranate and wasabi were scary to them, and much less so now because they're more mainstream.
Celine Endler, a marketing manager here, points out the success McCormick's had with Chipotle chili pepper.
We launched Chipotle several years ago, and then if you look at it, it's up 70% in sales in 5 years. Before, people would not even know how do you say Chipotle?
The fast food chain of the same name has no doubt helped with that. And says Peter Firth of the consulting firm FFF Associates, so have the changing demographics of America.
We've had a very big influx of immigrant populations from Mexico, from the Far East, the Southeast Asia areas, from India.
Along with people have come a broad array of restaurants. At the same time, Firth says, food blogs and food TV have spurred more home cooking. Add it all together and you end up with a much more adventurous national palate. Firth has looked at numbers from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and found that since the 70s, spice consumption has exploded.
Chili peppers grew almost 600%.
Cumin consumption has grown by almost 300%, cinnamon by 900%, and then there's ginger.
Well, ginger has grown phenomenally. It's on the order of 1,600-1,700%.
That's absolutely amazing, and it's actually so wonderful for me to hear.
Food writer Monica Bidet was born in India. Now she lives just outside Washington, D.C., where she writes and teaches classes about spices.
When I came here 20 years ago, one of the things I used to do is every time I went back home, I'd come back with a suitcase full of spices, of lentils. Everything used to come from there.
Now she gets everything from an Indian store nearby and from Amazon, where tandoori chicken spice mix goes for just a few dollars. Indian food does call for a lot of roasted spices, like the ones McCormick is selling, but Bidet says she prefers to do the roasting at home.
When you heat a pan and add a little bit of cumin and it starts sizzling, the whole room feels so toasty, smells amazing.
Now that's an experience you can't put in a bottle. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. The engineering supervisor for Morning Edition is Kevin Langley. Our technical director is Brian Jarbo. Audio engineers include Michael Cullen, Preston Brown, Greg Gavin, Gary Henderson, Ted Mebane, Dennis Nielsen, John Widoff, Stacey Abbott, Arthur Holliday-Laurent, and Renee Pringle with Theo Mondel here at NPR West.
Our executive producer is Marlika Sicca. The executive director of news programming is Ellen McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Don Gagne.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Steve Inskeep will be back with us on Monday. Don, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been fun.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. Here's a joke you might recall from 1994.
Three tomatoes are walking down the street. Papa tomato, mama tomato, and baby tomato. Baby tomato starts lagging behind, and Papa tomato gets really angry, goes back and squishes him. Says ketchup.
Hmm.
Ketchup.
That was Uma Thurman, of course, in Pulp Fiction. Now, here's the thing. Centuries earlier, Uma couldn't have made that bad joke, not because it wasn't funny or because ketchup hadn't been invented yet, but because the tomato was viewed as poisonous, dangerous. Chefs shunned it. But gradually, it made its way into our diets, our homes, our tasteless jokes. Journalist Arthur Allen tells the story of the tomato's redemption, popularization, and eventual modification in his new book, Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. And he joins us now from the studios of member station WSUI in Iowa City, Iowa. Arthur Allen, welcome to Weekend Edition.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I mentioned that in this book, you say that the tomato had really quite a hurdle in being introduced to Europe and North America because it was viewed as a poison. How did it win over its detractors?
I think it was just, you know, the tomato has a way of sort of wearing you down because it's unavoidable. There's so many different ways that you can eat it. And I think it caught on with the peasantry first in the south, in the Mediterranean, where it grows so well. And, you know, doctors all thought that tomatoes were poisonous, and that finally gave way to good sense and taste.
Mm-hmm. Another surprising chapter in tomato history is a court actually ruled about whether it was a vegetable or a fruit. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. None other than our own Supreme Court was called in to answer this question when vegetable and fruit importers were trying to get the New York Customs Office to allow them to import tomatoes without a duty. And at the time, you could import fruit without a duty, but vegetables had a surcharge. And they argued that tomatoes were not a vegetable, they were a fruit. And the court found that, yes, botanically, tomatoes are a fruit, but they're legally a vegetable.
There's that wonderful notion of throwing a rotten tomato at a politician or an actor. Apart from the legal niceties, why don't we do that any longer?
Well, I think it's because tomatoes are too hard now. And so it stops becoming a kind of gentle act of defiance that only leads to a dry cleaning bill, to something that, you know, could get you serious time in prison. I mean, you know, and you want those soft, goopy tomatoes if you're going to really get a politician or a bad musician. So I think we could still use our backyard tomatoes for throwing at politicians, but not commercial tomatoes.
Now, why this particular produce? I know that writers have been looking at salt or fish or certainly lots and lots of books on bread. You chose the tomato. Why?
Started out actually looking at strawberries, but I just found tomatoes are a much richer subject. I mean, there's just so many stories and lore, and they mean so much to many of us. I mean, anyone who cares about food usually has strong feelings about tomatoes. And part of the reason is just because, in a sense, the tomato is the original back garden summer edible that you remember from your grandmother's garden or your own garden. And then just the changes in the tomato and the way that people are often dissatisfied with, you know, the Safeway tomato or the supermarket tomato. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to find out, you know, how the supermarket tomato got to be the way it is.
Has the advent of the small farmer growing heirloom varieties and the farmers markets that we see had any impact on this massive global tomato enterprise? Does our desire for something really tasty right now make a difference?
I think it has. I mean, I think for one thing, you're seeing a lot more interest in the larger commercial tomato growers to introduce varieties that have flavor. I mean, flavor for decades was really an afterthought. Nowadays, if you want to compete, you can sell tomatoes at a higher price if you have more flavor.
Well, what is your favorite kind to grow?
I like the early girls because the sort of local season in Washington just started in the last few weeks. When I was in California, I had some that I really loved called the speckled peach. And so I brought the seeds back and I tried to grow them and they came out completely nothing burger tomatoes. And we just realize it's something about California, you know, the sun, the soil, whatever it is. And that's very characteristic of tomatoes, that certain types go in certain areas. But just the sheer diversity in the color and shape and so on is just very appealing. Because part of gardening is just the fun of it and the aesthetics of it. And then we fool ourselves into thinking that, you know, these are wonderful tomatoes when really they're just average.
Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your tomato quest with us. Arthur Allen is the author of Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. Thanks for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. Have a nice tomato-y summer.
Read about one grower's golden honey bunch tomatoes, which Allen describes as so extravagantly flavored they're nearly tropical, in an excerpt from Ripe at our website, npr.org.
You know, you might call this next story food for thought. In our series, The Human Edge, NPR Science Desk has been examining the evolutionary changes that make us uniquely human. Among them is our diet, or at least the diet of our ancestors. NPR science correspondent Christopher Joyce has found there really is such a thing as brain food.
Our ancestors ate their food raw. Fruit, leaves, maybe some nuts. And when they ventured down onto land, they added things like underground tubers, roots, and berries. It wasn't a very high-calorie diet. To get the energy you needed, you had to eat a lot and have a big gut to digest it all. And let me tell you, having a big gut has its drawbacks.
You can't have a large brain and big guts at the same time.
Leslie Aiello is an anthropologist and director of the Venner Gren Foundation in New York City, which funds research on evolution. Digestion, she says, was the energy hog of our primate ancestors' body. The brain was the poor stepsister who got the leftovers, until we discovered meat.
What we think is that this dietary change around 2.3 million years ago was one of the major significant factors in the evolution of our own species.
That period is when cut marks on animal bones appeared. Not a predator's tooth marks, but incisions that could only have been made by a sharp tool. That's one sign of our carnivorous conversion. Aiello's favorite clue is ickier. It's a tapeworm.
The closest relative of human tapeworms are tapeworms that affect African hyenas and wild dogs.
So sometime in our evolutionary history,
we actually shared saliva with wild dogs and hyenas.
That would have happened if, say, we were scavenging on the same carcass that hyenas were.
Exactly.
But dining with dogs was worth it. Meat is packed with lots of calories and fat. Our brain, which uses about 20 times as much energy as the equivalent amount of muscle, piped up and said, "Please, sir, I want some more." As we got more, our guts shrank because we didn't need a giant vegetable processor anymore. Our bodies could spend more energy on other things, like building a bigger brain. Sorry, vegetarians, but eating meat apparently made our ancestors smarter. Smart enough to make better tools, which in turn led to other changes.
If you look in your dog's mouth or your cat's mouth, and then you open up your own mouth and look at that, our teeth are quite different. And what allows us to do what a cat or dog can do are tools.
Tools meant we didn't need big, sharp teeth like other predators. Tools even made vegetable matter easier to deal with. As anthropologist Shara Bailey at New York University puts it, they were like external teeth.
You know, your teeth are really for processing food, of course, but if you do all the food processing out here, you know, if you're boiling things, if you're grinding things, then there's less pressure on your teeth to kind of pick up the slack.
Our teeth, jaws, and mouth changed, as well as our gut. But adding raw meat to our diet doesn't tell the whole food story, according to anthropologist Richard Wrangham. Wrangham invited me to his apartment at Harvard University to explain what he believes is the real secret to being human. All I had to do was to bring the groceries.
You're a hero. My goodness, holding all this stuff up.
Let me take these out and show you what I brought. Got a bit of steak, which I hope can fill in for kudu or antelope or something.
Excellent.
Appropriate.
Okay, that's great.
And a turnip. You can take it.
Oh, one. Excellent. Right, really good.
Well, since you're English, I thought that the idea would be to get some tubers and boil the hell out of them.
Absolutely.
Plus a mango, some peanuts, and potatoes. Wrangham says that even after we started eating meat, raw food just didn't pack the energy to build the big-brained, small-toothed modern human. He cites research that showed that people on a raw food diet, including meat and oil, lost a lot of weight, Many said they felt better, but also experienced chronic energy deficiency, and half the women in the experiment stopped menstruating. Now, it's not as if raw food isn't nutritious. It's just harder for the body to get at the nutrition.
Are you going to try some of this raw turnip?
You're going to make me do it.
Well, I'll try some too. They've got a tremendous amount of caloric energy in them. The problem is that it's in the form of starch, which, unless you cook it, does not give you very much.
Then there's all the chewing that raw food requires. Chimps, for example, sometimes chew for 6 hours a day. That actually consumes a lot of energy.
Plato said that if we were a regular animal, we wouldn't have time to sit around and write poetry. You know, he was right.
One solution might have been to pound food, especially meat, like this steak.
If our ancestors had used stones to mash the meat like this, then it would have reduced the difficulty that they would have had in digesting it. Are you going to try it?
I'll have at it. And that's quite easy to chew. It's not bad at all. But not as good as cooking that steak.
Onto the fire. Whoa.
That's what Wrangham says was the really big change that created our modern body. Someone discovered fire, no one knows exactly when, and then someone got around to putting steak and veggies on the barbie, like this one in Wrangham's kitchen. People said, hey, let's do that again. Besides better taste, cooked food had other benefits. For one thing, cooking breaks up the long protein chains in meat that makes them easier for stomach enzymes to digest.
The second thing is very clear, and that is that the muscle, which is made of protein, is wrapped up like a sausage in a skin, and the skin is collagen, connective tissue. And that collagen is very difficult to digest. But if you heat it, it turns to jelly.
As for the starchy foods, like our turnip, cooking gelatinizes the tough starch granules and makes them easier to digest as well. Even just softening food, which cooking does, makes it more digestible. In the end, you get more energy out of the food. Yes, cooking can damage some good things in raw food, like vitamins. But Wrangham argues that what's gained by cooking far outweighs the losses. I'm going to have some of the steak sitting under my nose.
Great, okay.
Wrangham likes to think that cooking also led to some of the finer elements of human behavior. It encourages people to share labor. It brings families and communities together at the end of the day and encourages conversation and storytelling. All very human activities.
Ultimately, of course, what makes us intellectually human is our brain, and I think that comes from having the highest quality of food in the animal kingdom, and that's because we cook.
So, as the Neanderthals like to say around the campfire, bon appetit.
Cheers.
So, cheers.
Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Who knew the Neanderthals spoke French? You can find all the stories in our Human Edge series at npr.org/science.
Tomatoes are ubiquitous in Italian cuisine, and renowned chef Scott Conant joins us now with some of his favorite tomato recipes. He's the owner of the Italian restaurants Scarpetta and Faustina and the host of the Food Network's primetime series 24-Hour Restaurant Battle. And he joins us on the phone from Toronto, where he's opening another restaurant. Congratulations, Chef Scott.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, we're speaking to you as an expert in Italian cooking, so I'd imagine you know a thing or two about tomatoes.
I like to think so. The thing I love most about tomatoes is their versatility. A good tomato, raw, with a little bit of salt and a touch of olive oil, is just one of the world's most simple pleasures for me. But also, when you cook them, they take on such a different form and really full-flavored.
So what are some of your favorite tomato dishes?
One of the things that we're really known for is a very simple tomato sauce, spaghetti with tomato and basil. And we take those tomatoes and we peel them and seed them. And then we just cook them for about 45 minutes with a little bit of salt and infused olive oil with garlic, basil, and crushed red pepper. And then we very simply crush it with one of those big potato mashers that you see. And then we just serve it with a little spaghetti that we toss and add a touch of basil to, a little Parmesan cheese, and one of those dishes that people come back to the restaurant for all the time. What I love about tomatoes in general is that you can do something so simple with them and achieve such a great product with it.
You know, your recipe got my mouth watering, but I was thinking of a friend of mine who has a similar recipe that she makes, and she's Italian-American, but she doesn't cook the tomato. And I guess the garlic almost kind of cooks it. It's just tons of garlic in her recipe.
Wow, that sounds delicious. She makes it with pasta?
Yes, of course.
There's also a very traditional tomato pasta recipe called pasta alla checca. And what they do is they take beautiful tomatoes and they cut them into maybe half-inch dice. And they mix it with a little bit of mozzarella, good extra virgin olive oil, a little bit of sea salt, and torn fresh basil. And they'll keep that in a bowl, room temperature, cold. And then they'll take hot pasta and just toss that directly inside a bowl. And then it's served and eaten straight away. And it's just a beautiful summer dish, I think.
It sounds like Italy's got to be a place you go to a lot for tomato fare.
Yeah, you know, it's unique because the tomato isn't indigenous to Italy, which some might think it would be. It was introduced to Italy from the New World. I just think the Italians seem to have mastered tomatoes. So even though it's not indigenous to that area, it really seems like they own it outright at this point.
I'd agree. Chef Scott Conan owns the Italian restaurant Scarpetta and Faustina. He's also the host of Food Network's 24-hour restaurant battle, and he joined us on the phone from Toronto. Last night, he opened a new Scarpetta in Toronto. Thanks so much for taking some time with us.
Thank you so much.